Once upon a time, there were four little rabbits.
How old are you, Johnny? She asked.
16.
We few, we happy few, we band of brothers.
It was the best of times. It was the worst of times.
A wise old king once said, "Of the making of books, there is no end." How true today. Of the overabundance of writing published each year, what's worth reading? The answer is simple. Read only the best. Come join the discussion on Just the Best Literature.
Hello again, everyone. Thanks for listening in today. Today, I want to introduce our new JBL series, Summer of Classics. From now until October, we will concentrate our reading and discussion on four pieces, I think, of some of the best classic literature. Now, we've announced these on social media, but let me just tell you the list again. Our first book is going to be Pride and Prejudice by Jane Austen. Our second book is titled Great Expectations, that's by Charles Dickens. And then we're going to be doing 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea. And, of course, our mystery book, which I'll reveal in the midsummer. Now, I know that many homeschool families listen to this program, and this Summer of Classics is designed for you. I know I went to a college prep high school, and one of the things I thought was really great is we had a summer reading program, and we were given a list of books to read over the summer. And I believe that really helped me, you know, stay in step with a continuing education attitude during the summer months. It was really good for me. I didn't suffer from what many teachers called it a brain drain. And in other words, I kept myself active in reading all summer. So this will be a special program today and will run a little less than an hour. But why are we going to read these books? Well, there's some good reasons. And to help me answer this question, I would like to use a new book titled The Vanishing American Adult by U.S. Senator Ben Sasse from Nebraska. Now, I highly recommend this book to all parents of children, but especially those parents of teens, and then especially, again, to homeschool parents. Now, Sasse's book does deal with this coming-of-age crisis plaguing American youth today. And essentially, what he's saying is that the young people today don't want to grow up. They don't want to become adults. And I do think he has some incredible insight on how to help teens want to become an adult and shake off what he calls the Peter Pan syndrome. And if you remember that famous line or the famous song from any musical you may have seen about Peter Pan, or if you've read the book, Peter Pan says, "I don't want to grow up." Well, that really is so prevalent with among our young people today. And even here at Herbert W. Armstrong College, we have what we consider great students, really driven students, but some that do come to us really appear they don't really want to be adults. They want to kind of just stay kids and not have to worry about getting out, getting a job, you know, making a contribution to society. And so I think this is happening really probably, I think, in every level of maybe American society today. So what I want to do is I want to kind of split this program up into two segments. For this first segment, I want to just bring you several ideas from Chapter 8 of Sasse's book called Build a Bookshelf. Now, in the second segment of the program, I'll introduce Jane Austen's Pride and Prejudice. And I think these two really do, work together, the two segments, and you'll see that as we go through. Now, Sasse's book outlines what parents need to do to make sure their kids grow up and assume adult responsibilities. It is really a great book. Now, no book is perfect. I mean, we have to admit that. And, of course, Ben has his own ideas on a few things. I don't necessarily agree with everything he says. But I do agree with most of what he says in this Chapter 8. And the title of this chapter is Build a Bookshelf. And he's really talking to parents of teens. He's talking to parents that have let's say, younger children still in school. And he really is emphasizing that what parents need to do is they need to build a bookshelf for their teen or for their younger person. They need to come up with a list of books that they believe their children should have read before they leave home. But here's what this chapter is really all about. It really does show that if teens are going to really, let's say, make a strong entrance into adulthood, they need to be readers of books. And there's a reason for that. Now, we've covered this on other programs with, you know, Just the Best Literature, and how a book is so much more tactile, it's so much more engaging than it is to read even books on a screen. Now, again, I'm not saying that you should never read a book on a screen or, read books on screens. In fact, I like to take my iPad when I travel on an airplane. I like to use my iPad because it's easier to carry around. If I wanted to carry two or three books, you know, in a briefcase, that's a lot of fumbling. But if you have an iPad, you can carry an unlimited number of books, really. So I do think there's a time for it. But Senator Sasse has a lot of valuable things to say in this chapter. And if we just look at the whole chapter, I'm not going to be able to cover all of it in this first segment. But his overall point is that a young person, to become a productive, contributing adult, every teen must become readers of books. Not screen addicts. They need to become readers of books, and by choice. And I know over the years of my teaching of, you know, college sophomores, I know one time I was asking someone if they liked a book, and they said no, they really didn't like the book that we were reading, but they had made some good comments in class. And I had said, well, why are you reading this book then? And they said, well, because you're making me. And so we really want to teach our children and encourage our children to love reading and to see the value and importance of reading. And Sasse is really saying in his book is not only do parents build a bookshelf for their teens, but you actually teach the teens to build their own bookshelf of books that they know are important and enjoyable to them, and books that they can talk about with their friends and get this conversation or get discussion going on. So again, he just has a lot of good things to say. But I think it is interesting. I know there, like I said at the beginning of this program, there are a lot of homeschoolers out there listening in. Well, Senator Sasse and his wife are also homeschoolers. They have three children, and they have been teaching them at home. And what they did is they developed a required reading list of books for their children. And they told their children these books were must-reads. And they also said they had to read them before their children left home. In other words, you know, there's only so much time you have. And I know I have one daughter that does homeschooling with her children. I have another daughter who just has young children. She's getting ready to homeschool with her children. And when you're taking care of a home, you're taking care of a children, you're supporting your husband, there's not a whole lot of time. And so when you develop these book lists, you really have to realize and impress upon your children they only have so much time. And the more important time is time you spend with books, let's say, versus time you spend on a computer or time you spend watching television or time you spend watching films. And that's really what's going to help you. You have to realize that, you know, if you're going to encourage your children to have a bookshelf or you're going to encourage your children to read, then you're also going to have to make the time available for them to read. But all parents have to do this. You have to really see the need for this, and it's really important for education. Now, I don't believe, like I said, I really believe you should get this book, parents. I really highly recommend it. But it doesn't mean that you have to follow Sasse's list. He does provide a list in the book. We've talked to you about Bloom's list. You know, there's like thousands of books on the Western canon to read. But you can make your own list. You can certainly follow Sasse's list as an example. But again, you can build your own list. So again, why are we reading these books this summer? Well, I think you'll see that as we go through some of these quotes of the book, why we are reading these books. And again, Pride and Prejudice, You know, Austen's Pride and Prejudice, Dickens, Great Expectations, the, 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea. Those are not really easy books. I mean, they're not easy to read. But they do something vital for teens, and it does something really vital for their brains. And that's what we have to really see the benefit in. But here's what Sass begins in this chapter 8. This is on page 207 when you buy the book. You can go back and listen to this podcast at any time you want. But he talks about America in the book, and he talks about what made America great. And he also talks about what is bringing America down right now. And really, it has to do a lot with education. But here's what he says. He says, our settlers and founders were an opinionated lot, people of controversial ideas, life and death ideas. They wanted the liberty to worship and to argue freely and not to be subject to a Church of England they considered decadent. The Puritans who left the old world for the new brought with them a particular piety and a strain of democratic civil-mindedness that would eventually give birth to modern constitutional self-government. And so what he's saying is, look, America has been the home of ideas, and it was these ideas that made America the home of the brave. You know, we've heard that expression, America, the home of the brave. But really, America has been the home of ideas. Now, he goes on to say, he says, we cannot understand them, meaning the Puritans or meaning the original settlers of this or this nation of theirs we've inherited, without grasping that one crucial and at the same time radically new element that made possible the widespread dissemination of religious and political ideas they carried with them. And he said it was the printed word. And that's really true. And we've even talked about Ben Franklin in one of our former broadcasts. And, Ben Franklin became a publisher of books. He became a publisher of articles, and he became a disseminator of ideas. And, you know, he had strong opinions, and other people had strong opinions at that time. And, you know, we're seeing all that kind of, fall to the sidelines. And I've just been reading some articles on the American Scholar about what's happening in our college campuses, and people are afraid today to share their opinions and their ideas and their beliefs and their religious thinking. They're afraid to do it. They won't do it. And, I think if we brought our ancestors back to life, and, we showed them what was happening in America today, they would be absolutely shocked to see the way Americans are. And, we're quickly losing our heritage of being a people of great and controversial ideas. We are quickly becoming a nation of people who are afraid to express opinions, well, that may not be in line with the accepted norm. And there is, by the way, there is this accepted norm out there, and it's being really promoted by, the elite of this earth. It's really being promoted by the news media. It's being promoted by journalists. It's being promoted by college and university administrators. It's being really kind of crammed down the throats of our college students, by faculty members. And it's really all about this whole term called political correctness. Now, I believe what we have to face in this country is that political correctness has morphed from an adherence to the norms of basic decency. In other words, you don't want to be out there making derogatory statements about others. You don't want to, just be absolutely, mean and nasty in your opinions. You know, there is even a Bible term or a verse that says you need to speak the truth in love. And so we should be able to have debate without, being bloody about it. You know, we should be able to stand up and say what we believe without being criticized for it. But that's not the political correctness we have today. What we have is really a persistent attempt to suppress the expression of unwelcome beliefs and ideas. That's what's going on. And I even talked earlier about these silent book clubs. where, you know, people will go out in large groups and they'll read books, but they won't discuss it. They won't tell their opinions. That's just really strange. But I really believe that's this spirit of, well, let's just not have any discussion of any ideas that you may not like or I may not like. And that is not how this country was built. And, you know, we really have to begin to see that. Here's another quote by Ben on page 208. He says, "The men and women who founded our nation did so by riding the wave of the print revolution. Their moment was historically unprecedented, and our failure to remember this neglects the related truth that what we read or don't read still drives not only what we believe, but how we engage with each other and how we make decisions about our future." And so reading this print revolution, the ability to be able to print volumes of books and then be able to disseminate to them to thousands of people, it really does build up society. It really does build up a nation. And we're forgetting that. And it really does matter what we read or we don't read. And we have to instill that in our children as well. He goes on to say, he says, "Among the responsibilities of each citizen in a particular democracy is keeping ourselves sufficiently informed so that we can participate effectively, argue our positions honorably, and hopefully forge sufficient consensus to understand each other and then to govern." Now that's what reading is all about. And I know I grew up in a family, my parents were readers. And my father didn't go past the eighth grade in terms of school, but he read, and my mother read. And, you know, he was a very intelligent man and, you know, a very capable person. And so we have to see this. This is what we're missing, and this is what we're missing in our schools. I know I just read another article this morning where there's a teacher who doesn't want to teach Shakespeare to her high school students because she feels it's too hard for them, and she doesn't understand it. She doesn't think they can understand it. And really, that's just a lot of, well, it's garbage, because I teach Shakespeare to sophomore college students. I teach it to junior college students, and, you know, it's a little difficult to start reading, but there are words that Shakespeare uses we still use today. It's not like old English. It's not that way at all. And it's just really, it's a sense of laziness, and it's really cheating our students. Now he goes on to say, he says, "To this end, our critical faculties must be in top condition. The ability not just to evaluate sources, weigh evidence, and check facts, but also to understand motivations, resolve apparent contradictions, cut through ambiguities, and maybe even discover truths. These skills and habits are in ill repair, and the informed contentiousness that a free republic demands is beleaguered and fraying." And so what he's really talking about now is young people, is they can't do these things. They can't evaluate sources. They can't weigh evidence. They can't check facts. You know, they don't know how to do those things, and that's why reading a good, challenging, tough book or a good, challenging, interesting story is going to help build those faculties. And he says, again, just a little bit further down on this page, this is page 280, he says, "Critical, engaged reading skills are not a luxury, but rather a necessity for responsible adults and responsible citizens." And so when you read, you know, you want to get into something a little deeper than People magazine. And that's why, you know, the classics that I think we've chosen here for the summer will really help you to do that. He goes on to say, "America's future depends on the kind of thinking that reading presupposes and nourishes, and such thinking demands a rebirth of reading." And so that's what we want to do, and that's why we even began to develop the concept for Just the Best Literature, is we really want to, well, you know, give this rebirth to reading. And I know, you know, we're receiving more and more comments on Facebook that people are really enjoying some of the books we've chosen. We just finished with, you know, Driving China, and you know, some people were just amazed at the poverty still in China. And because on the news you see these great cities like Beijing and Hong Kong, and you think everything is just really wealthy, But if you look at most of the population of China, they're living in absolute poverty, and they're illiterate. You know, they can't read, they can't write. And so it is really shocking. He goes on to talk about in his book about a friend of his that they were in school together, and he is a very well-educated individual, this Senator Sass is. And these two men, they met when they were at school, and they are now married with kids, and they every now and again they get together and they talk about how to help their kids. Remember, the Sasses are homeschool kids, and I have a feeling, I mean, they homeschool their kids, and I have a feeling his friend does the same thing. But his friend wrote him a note one time and said, Carrie and I, now this is his friend, and his name is Scott. He says, Carrie and I worry that our kids don't understand the glories of books enough. They don't love them enough. What books do you want your kids to have read by the time they leave home? And I thought that was really, really a good discussion there. That do you see the glories of books? And, that's how we overcome this, what they call, this experts are calling digital distraction. I mean, even if you read a book on an iPad, there's a tendency then, well, I need to check, my social media sites, or I need to check my email, or I need to check this, or maybe I need to check my bank statements. And I know I fall into that. I mean, we have to use computers. I have this wonderful computer at work. It's an iMac. It's got all these glorious things on it. But really, I work very hard to shut down my email. I work very hard to shut down these things and not get distracted. And the thing is, we have glorified technology. We've glorified our electronics. And we need to really get back to developing the glories of books and what books do for you. And I remember, like I said, when we had this summer reading program, and we were issued our books for the summer, I was always so excited. It's like you could touch them, you could look at the beautiful covers on them, and then you could start reading. And it did give you different ideas for the summer. I remember, reading books by C.S. Lewis and some of the other more famous authors, like George Orwell. We had to read some of those books. And so it was really, really very exciting. And so what Ben Sass did with he and his wife, they saw that, and they began to make their own list. And he writes this on this page 209. He says, he's talking about he and his wife. He says, we realize that for them, meaning their children, to claim their full inheritance as Americans, they need to read and to understand the role of reading in our republic. They need to feel a desire in their chest to become people of the book, even amid the seductive lure of the screen. And this won't happen without a program for what to read. And so again, we can talk to our students, we can talk to our teens, we can talk to our children over and over again, tell them we have to read, tell them they have to read. But if we don't get a program for them, well, they're not going to do it. And he says, we aim for our kids to leave home for college or work, not necessarily having finished a great reading list, but definitely having built and begun to get to know their own great starter reading list. And so they took it one step further. They wanted their students or their kids to be developing their own reading list. And, that's really a laudable goal, and all parents should have that. He goes on to say, he says, and so we direct and encourage them to build their own long-term reading list, to persuade others to read their favorites, to be humble and curious in accepting the recommendations of others, and to actively adjust their list as they wrestle with and learn from others. This process we've created is not the same as claiming that they can develop one fixed canon of what to read that is right for everyone, but rather what they should have and in terms of an evolving list of their own that they will use in prioritizing their reading of 50 or 60 key books. Now, that really is a challenge. How many parents out there in homeschool, or how many parents out there have this list of 50 or 60 books that you think your kids should read? So again, I can't cover absolutely everything in this chapter, but he gives so many ideas. He said, if your child's going to become truly literate, well, that's going to be their choice. The reason why he wants his kids to read 50 or 60 books, he wants to really, you know, get them engaged. He wants them to, you know, engage their minds, engage their ideas. When they're reading, he wants them actively questioning. He recommends his kids read 60 minutes of a book a day. That means no television, no computers, you know, no iPads. And he said, that's what we need to do. Now, it is interesting. You can read from a, like I said, you can read from an iPad. But here, I'm just going to finish this segment with this quote. He said, and this is from page 210. He says, obviously, movies and television shows can create a shared experience of a story. But a culture ruled by print is very different from one ruled by images. Print shapes the way we write, speak, think, and remember. So this is why we've chosen, you know, Pride and Prejudice by Jane Austen. This is why we've chosen Great Expectations. This is why we've chosen 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea. And this is why we've chosen our fourth book, which you're going to see is probably one of the best written and most important books of all Western society. Okay, so why again then do we have these books? Why do we have Pride and Prejudice? Why do we have 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea? Why do we have, you know, Great Expectations? Well, these books will help you, and they will help your teens develop these skills of attention and engagement and active questioning. They're going to help your teens in the way they write and they speak and they think and remember. Now, these books are a challenge to read, but they were the leading books in their time, and they challenged people's ideas, and they generated discussion, and I know they will do the same for you. So this is Dennis Leap, and you're listening to Just the Best Literature. I'll be right back.
Is summer vacation drying your brain into a wrinkled raisin? Plunge into something different. Join Dennis Leap, host of Just the Best Literature, for a scintillating summer of reading. Drench your mind with classics such as Jane Austen's Pride and Prejudice, Charles Dickens' Great Expectations, and Jules Verne's 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea. Be a part of reading and discussing to build a brawny brain. Yeah! JBL's Summer of Classics series begins June 26th. Just the Best Literature airs Mondays at 8 a.m. CDT on KPCG.FM and 101.3 in North Edmond, Oklahoma. Join us on Twitter at JBLiterature1 or on Facebook by searching Just the Best Literature to see news, facts, and creatively designed quotes. Also, leave comments and communicate with us. We want to hear from you. Just the Best Literature airs Mondays at 8 a.m. on KPCG.FM and 101.3 in North Edmond, Oklahoma.
Well, I'm back. My assistant posted a tweet saying we wanted to interview Jane Austen for the program, but she was hard to reach. Now, that was intended to be humorous, but really, my intent and sentiment is real there. I think Jane Austen would be just a fantastic author to interview for our JBL series, but obviously that's not going to happen. So what I thought I'd do for this segment of this special program, I thought what I'd do is just kind of give you a short biography of her. Now, I'm assuming that a lot of you out there listening for Pride and Prejudice, you probably already know the story, you know the characters, but I'm sure there's a portion of you that do not. And again, for all of you homeschoolers out there and all your homeschooler parents, I think you ought to encourage your teens to go ahead and read Pride and Prejudice again, even if they have read it already, because you always get more out of classic books like this the more times you read them. But anyway, Jane Austen was born in Steventon, England in 1775, so you know, that's a little while ago. She also died in 1818 at the age of like 41. So she did not live a long life. Now, she lived in Steventon, England for the first 25 years of her life. And then eventually she ended up at Chowton. And, we'll bring that up again here in a few minutes. But it is interesting that Austen did come from a really rather large family. She had six brothers, And they became successful admirals and landowners and all of that. And then she had one sister. Her name was Cassandra. Now, history tells us that Jane and Cassandra were almost inseparable. And, you know, they were very, very close friends, and they were very close as sisters. And, in fact, one of the most famous portraits we have of Jane Austen was actually drawn by her sister Cassandra. She had a very interesting family life. Now, her father, George Austen, was the rector of a local parish, so that means he was like the minister there. And he diligently attempted to find an appropriate boarding school for his children. And in England at that time, that was the thing to do. You sent your children away to boarding school. But he couldn't find one that met his standards. And he obviously was a well-educated man. And he had very high standards that he wanted for his children. And at that time, you know, in England, education was very important. And people, even though they were wealthy, even though that, you know, there were these landed, you know, landowners and very wealthy earls and all of that, they still made sure their children were highly educated. And so essentially, what he did is he couldn't find a boarding school, so he homeschooled his children. And so, you know, we could think that homeschool is kind of a modern invention. Really, it isn't. I mean, a lot of children were schooled right at home. Sometimes they had a governess. Sometimes the parents, you know, took over the education. And, you know, Mr. Austen also, he boarded several children with his own family and taught them. And so he kind of had his own little homeschool boarding school. So to me, that just really should be really encouraging for all of you homeschool parents out there. Now, how did he educate them? And I think this is interesting, and especially in light of what we're doing this summer, is he educated his children by making them reading the classics. Now, what he's talking about are the Roman classics of history, and he's talking about the Greek, you know, and I'm sure they read Latin, and they would read Latin texts and understand languages. I'm sure they were taught language. So that's a little different than what I'm saying in terms of classics. I'm talking about classic novels. But the focus was on reading. And that was one of the most prime parts of education, you know, centuries ago, was to read hard stuff, to read the classics, to read things actually in Greek and read things in Latin. And so, really, our modern education has really, really kind of gotten soft. And we just have to both, not both, but we all have to just admit that together. Now, Jane and her sister were both very pretty, and they were both very popular. And like I said before, they had a very affectionate family, but they also had a wide circle of friends. And this really kind of fed into Jane's desire to be a writer, and the family and the friends she had and the association, because her father was, you know, a minister at the church, she would have had an opportunity to work, you know, with the whole congregation and with the poor, maybe in their area as well. She would have had plenty of material, you know, to write about. And so, remember, her world, it was really kind of different than ours, but her world was the landed gentry and the country clergy. And so she would have met a lot of different people and had a lot of different experiences. And, of course, she used all of these in her novel. Now, her father did die in 1805. And at that point, two of her brothers had already left home, and they had gone on to become, you know, military men and admirals, and they had their own families. But Jane and her family, the rest of her family, they did. For a while, they lived at Southampton, and then they moved on to Chawton, and if I'm saying that correctly. But anyway, you can see her home there in that area today. Jane began to write in her teens, and to me, you know, that's really, you know, really quite laudable. And there have been other authors that wrote in their teens, and I know we even have. you know, students that work with us here at the college. And some of them have been, you know, doing their own little writing stories and novels and things like that since they were young children as well. So that's just a sign of, you know, education, and it's a sign of reading. And it's a sign of wanting to, well, communicate ideas. But again, she began to write in her teens, and she completed the original manuscript of Pride and Prejudice, but she completed her original manuscript of Pride and Prejudice. It was first titled First Impressions, and she began writing that between the years 1796 and 1797. Now, it is kind of interesting, and we'll give you a few more other details about this. But a publisher rejected the manuscript, and it was not until 1809 that Austin began to, develop the revisions that would bring it to its final form. Now, Pride and Prejudice was finally published in January 1813. But this was not her first novel. Her actual first novel that was published was Sense and Sensibility. And that novel achieved popularity immediately. And the popularity of Sense and Sensibility, and of course, Pride and Prejudice, is still extant today. Now, Austin also in her lifetime published four more novels. She published Mansfield Park, Emma, Northanger, Abbey, and then Persuasion. And actually, these last two, Northanger, Abbey, and Persuasion, they were not published until 1818, and that was a year after her death. So they were published posthumously. And so it's one of the things that's really amazing about, let's say, Jane Austen and her novels is they have rarely been out of print. And in fact, because they are kind of modern and they have this modern flair to them, they're still very popular today. Now, here's one of the ironic things about Austen in her life. And again, some of you that know her well and know her writing well probably are already familiar with this. But when Austen was publishing, she published anonymously. And at that time in England, it just wasn't necessarily seen as appropriate that a woman would be, you know, a writer and publishing. And so only her immediate family knew that she was authoring these novels. And so she never really was known in her time. She really wasn't known as a novelist or a writer in her time. And if you read some of the biographies of her, when she was writing, she would write in one room of her family home. And there was a door that would indicate to her that there was company in the house, and she would hurry up and scurry, and she would hide her manuscript so that no one knew that she was actually writing these novels. And so it is kind of an interesting thing. Of course, there's some other stories of other, you know, writers in England, that female writers that had to write under male names and things like that. Now, it is also kind of interesting that she really kind of stayed a private person. And I think maybe she liked writing anonymously, but again, she didn't have this, you know, author's reputation, but she was also to keep her privacy. And, you know, at that time, English society was really more male oriented, and everybody today is talking about, you know, privilege and white privilege, and, you know, they're really more epithets than they are a picture of reality. But at that time there was privilege, and if you were, you know, in the land of gentry, you did have more privileges than you did if you were in a lower social class. And of course, Austen talks about this in her novels. And so, but again, it would not have been acceptable for her as a female to be writing. Now, I think that also, and most biographies agree with this, that Austen may have really enjoyed the anonymity anyway, because there was a real, at that time period, there was a real attitude, or maybe we should say an atmosphere of repression. The Napoleonic Wars were going on, and there was this, monarchies were threatened, England was threatened, and, there was a lot of government censorship of, literature. And so this way she could protect herself and protect her family if she wrote anonymously in case, the government wanted to come after them or anything like that. So we have to remember that Austen was writing that time about the English society and how stratified it was and how there was class divisions. A lot of your, let's say, the upper crust in England, they were rooted in family connections with wealth. So, it could have been a dangerous thing. She could have looked like she was criticizing the monarchy and things like that. So to remain anonymous was really good. But it is interesting that Austen, I mean, she's really just a great writer. She's humorous at times. She's funny at times. But she is really critical at times. And, in her writing, Austen is often critical of the assumptions and the prejudices of the upper-class England. I mean, one of the big things that she does, and you see this right at the very beginning of Pride and Prejudice, is she does distinguish between internal merit, or the goodness of a person, and the external merit, or the rank and possessions of a person. And, she really does highly glorify internal merit. She really criticizes external merit. And we see this clearly in the very opening of Pride and Prejudice with the characters of Mr. Bingley and Mr. Darcy. I mean, you can see Mr. Bingley, he's wealthy, he's very kind. He's kind of, let's say, people in the upper class and the middle class. But then you have Mr. Darcy come in. Mr. Darcy's very dashing. He's very wealthy, but, he mistreats Elizabeth Bennet, who is a different class than he is, and he's kind of a snob towards her. And so you can see that she really does, really pick on these things. Now, even though she does frequently satirize snobs, she also pokes some fun at the poor breeding and the misbehavior of, let's say, the lower class or those lower on the social scale. And so, in other words, what I'm saying is Jane Austen really did believe in good breeding, and she did believe in appropriate behavior. And in some ways, while she's poking fun at them, I think she probably also understood it was a matter of education. But I think also if you look at Austen, in many ways, I think she probably was just a realist. And, she does take a lot of criticism for the way she wrote. But I think she probably gives us a realistic picture of England at that time. And we have to accept that at that time in England, social mobility was very limited, and there was a lot of class consciousness in the people, and it was very strong. And you can see that even with when she talks about Mrs. Bennet, they weren't of the higher aristocracy; they were lower. And it seems like Mrs. Bennet's whole goal is to get her daughters, her five daughters, married to a higher class, wealthy individual. And so again, that's really not even anything new, even in America. There are families that work at that to make sure their daughters marry well and marry wealthy people. And I'm just thankful that my wife's parents were not that way, because my wife certainly didn't marry a very wealthy person. But anyway, she does really address all those things, and I think that's what makes books like Pride and Prejudice and Emma and Sense and Sensibility very interesting. I mean, if you just think about, the whole PBS series on Downton Abbey, I mean, that was one of the most fascinating shows in America, and it's because we're all mystified by that kind of a society. There you have a very stratified society. You know, you had the servants downstairs and you had, you know, the aristocracy upstairs. And so it really does make for some really good stories. But I do think, I think a fair way to say it is Austin was just realistic. Now, it's really amazing how how she uses or takes advantage of these socially regimented ideas. And, you know, she talks about them, you know, through the writing. And again, this is where I've been talking about active thinking. When you're reading it, there's more going on than just the story. She's really trying to communicate what's going on in terms of, well, how regimented society is. She's also talking about what is appropriate behavior and what is inappropriate behavior. You know, she really talks a lot about gender and how that factors into her work. I mean, it's a, you know, it was very appropriate at that time for young men to be in the military or to be in the church or to be in the law. That she talks about those things, even, you know, when they're having all these social galas and they're at dances, you know, the young women are looking at the men and they, you know, there's even a military man, you know, involved in this novel. You know, her father, again, he was a rector, and so there's people involved with the church or the law. There's lawyers in the novel. But it's interesting that the only means for self-improvement for women in her books seem to be the acquisition of wealth through marriage. And so it is really, I think it's a very, again, just interesting concepts. But we have to remember these were the world that she lived in. This was the world she lived in. I know there are some critics that really criticize her, well, for not having a story about the poor people and or the servants that she would have been around. I mean, certainly she saw all this because of her father's work with the church. But the thing is Austin wrote about the things she really knew very much about. She wrote about things that were passionate to her. And so I think it's, in some ways, you know, the critics can be overcritical about what she was doing. But, you know, the whole, one of the thrusts in the book, you know, is that it's very clear that the minds of these young women and the minds of the mother are always on successful marriage. And, you know, that was a big level of accomplishment then. And, of course, Austin does bring out that you know, the characters eventually in the book, or the main characters eventually do marry for love. And, you know, there are misrepresentations of people. There are misperceptions of people. And then she kind of resolves this all towards the end. Now, the thing we have to accept about the reality is that the young women of Austin's day had more freedom to choose their husbands than in the early 18th century. And so, you know, we could maybe look back and think this is really bad, but actually it had been worse earlier. And so, you know, there were a lot of arranged marriages, and there are still areas of the world where there are arranged marriages. Even in India, there are still arranged marriages. And so today, I mean, we don't see that hardly at all, except there might be in more of your elite societies here, even in America, there might be some arranged marriages, but it still would be different than it was, you know, in the time of Austin. And so I don't believe that Austin really portrays a limited world like the critics do, you know, accuse her of doing. But I do think she does talk about her own world, and she's not talking about the world of the poor because she didn't live that way. And so you know, today we seem to have, again, we should be concerned about the poor. And certainly we should reach out to them. But I think in some ways, you know, our society has come to the point where, especially in America, where we actually are doing so much for the poor, we're actually not helping them, we're actually hurting them. And so you know, we shouldn't transfer our 21st century values onto, you know, a book that was written in the, you know, early 1800s. And so that's, I think that's where a lot of critics make their mistakes today. So, So in general, I think Austin really does, she kind of occupies this curious position between the 18th and 19th century. And I know that, you know, when I was in college, we studied literature, and one of her favorite writers at that time was Dr. Samuel Johnson. And, you know, he was even, you know, popular when I was in school. And you know, there were classes where people would read Johnson. And so she does quote him. And but I think what we have to remember about this book as we get into it is that Jane Austen's plots really do feature characters that are not unlike we are today. And I do think, even though their society was rigid, and even though there were problems at that time, there's still enough modern interest, let's say the way people, you know, would like court, or, you know, how they fall in love, and, you know, and how they're interested in each other, or maybe the intrigues that go on among people that are dating. I mean, I think that's all very, very modern. So it's really, that's what makes them so interesting. And I know that even getting ready for the Summer of Classic series, you know, several of our young students, and also several other of our, you know, instructors here at Imperial Academy, they were just asking me all the time, are you going to do Pride and Prejudice? Couldn't we do Pride and Prejudice? Can we get Pride and Prejudice on the radio? And so it's a very popular, you know, very popular book. And I think there is a lot that we can discuss and we can talk about it. So it really is the modernity of her novels that I think make them so popular today. And so it really is kind of fascinating. So next time, I really have put together a ladies-only, very special panel. And it's going to be made up of my wife and then one of our other instructors here at Imperial Academy. And I will announce them today. I'm not going to announce them now. And then also one of our senior college students who actually lives in England. And so we're going to try and get her in by Skype. And so I'm trying to get all that worked out still. But the thing is, we do have a special ladies panel. And so I think it's going to be a lot of fun. And then we're going to do two programs with them. And then I have a special men's panel. And we're going to do two programs with our guys. And so one thing that you might want to do is just, you know, start looking at all the characters. You can get online and you can look up the characters and just try to get to know them. If you haven't read the book, if you have read the book, I know you already know the characters. But it's a good place to start there and get to know all the characters before you start reading. So again, we'll be talking next time about the overall plot, and we'll be talking about these characters a lot as we go through these next four programs. So it looks like we are running out of time. I would very much like to hear what you have to say about our Summer Classic series, or maybe I should say it, our Summer of Classic series. And of course, then next time we will have, hopefully, formally formed our special ladies only panel to discuss Jane Austen's Pride and Prejudice. Of course, I'll be there too to keep the discussion within the time limits. That is going to be a challenge. So please write me any comments you may have to jbl@pcog.org. You can follow JBL on Twitter at jbliterature1. You can also follow JBL on Facebook. The address is facebook.com/justthebestliterature. And remember, you can leave me a comment on Facebook. And for all those that have been doing that, thank you so much. So until next time, keep reading.
You've been listening to Just the Best Literature on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, streaming online at kpcg.fm and thetrumpet.com.